Persons listening to this show should experience varying degrees of euphoria and might radiate a warm glow of truth from their entire being. This phenomenon sometimes lasts hours after a typical brain massage. If you are listening with another lights on listener and they begin to glow, don't be concerned. This is a phenomenon normally associated with Pastor Scheidbach's patented brain massage technique and merely means the truth has set them free. Stand by. The Brain Massage Show is about to blow your mind. Devil beware. Pastor Scheidbach is on the air.
Hello, my friends. I'm Jerry Scheidbach, pastor at the Lighthouse in your brain masseur. Get ready for your brain massage. Happy New Year. The last show for 2016. And I have resisted the impulse to do a reprise of the year or brain massage best of. We're going to stay laser focused on current issues that concern God-fearing patriots. Today, there are so many things we can go into. But I've decided to focus in on the president-alleged coming out party. Yeah, it's time for your brain massage.
Served here, flavored with delectable wit, succulent sagacity, luscious logic, a gourmet meal for the mind.
Here from the Eagle's Perch, where I write and produce the Brain Massage Show, we can see far and wide. We can look deep into the future and far into the past. And from the perspective of that one who knows the end from the beginning, we can hope to rightly understand what is going down here on planet Earth. Obama decided to use his lame duck session, as the president alleged, to give all his enemies as much trouble as he can. He plunged the knife of betrayal deep into the back of Israel. With evidence, by the way, that his administration actually initiated this whole thing and helped craft the UN resolution that he denies having any part in. Other than withholding America's veto, which allowed the resolution to pass. And they've been trying to get this passed for many years now. Additionally, Obama has released an army of environmental bureaucracy-empowering regulations against Americans with a price tag exceeding $5 billion. And he has expelled 35 Russian diplomats, closed down two Russian compounds in New York and Maryland, all of this to punish Putin for messing with his election tampering. The ruse to convince Americans Russians hacked the election. You know, that has actually manipulated the vote totals. It's working among the idiots on the left, or many of them. And I'm guessing these are the explicit publicized elements of Obama's responses to Russian hacking. You do remember he promised some of what he will be covert or secret. Very ominous. Ah, looky here. See, Obama is warning. He said, quote, "These actions are not the sum total of our response to Russia's aggressive activities. We will continue to take a variety of actions at a time and place of our choosing, some of which will not be publicized," end quote. What exactly does this man think he's doing here? The president alleged has been a busy boy. So what is he up to? Throwing a temper tantrum over his loss of the White House and both houses of Congress? And what was it, 1,000 mayor, governor seats throughout the country? And with all of that, the almost certain dismantling of his legacy. I mean, the coming erasure of Obama's attempt to demolish America as founded. Hallelujah. Is he attempting to establish or to beef up his resume for future employment as perhaps a global level community organizer? Is he maneuvering for a job at the UN? Is he posturing for a high level appointment in the New World Order? In other words, Cruz is cruising to defund the UN, and the Congress is talking about it, and I'm all for it, man. Get us out of that beast. After all of Obama's public posturing as friend to Israel, you know, at one time even wearing the yarmulke. Did you see the pics Bibi tweeted of Obama wearing the traditional Jewish head covering? Very cute. Or when President-alleged Obama said, quote, "I'm the closest thing to a Jew that has ever sat in the Oval Office," end quote. Listen, Clinton was more of the first black president than you could ever claim to be the first Jewish president. But anyway, David Axelrod recalled Obama's reaction to those accusing him of being anti-Israel. Obama said, quote, "You know, I think I'm the closest thing to a Jew that has ever sat in this office. For people to say that I am anti-Israel or even worse, anti-Semitic, it hurts," end quote. Well, judging from your actions, sir, I don't think you hurt at all with regard to that. He claimed to be called the first Jewish president by Goldberg, But we have known all along that Obama is a closet Muslim Brotherhood homeboy, born in Kenya, complete with a phony birth certificate. Hey, did you know that really 52% of Americans continue to believe that Obama was born in Kenya? That according to a Washington Post article. I mean, it's hard to blame them, since Michelle Mabel said Kenya was his home country back in the day, you know. And we're still wondering why Hawaii has never verified the birth certificate Obama floated out there, finally relented and put out there to prove he was born in Hawaii. And I do think we owe Trump some thanks for that one, nor do we yet know why he did, that is, Obama did everything that he could to avoid releasing his birth certificate up till then. I mean, the one from the hospital in Hawaii, which we've never seen, using every legal maneuver available to him to quash all efforts to compel the hospital to release it. So I continued to call him the president alleged, as I said, and I will. So why would he throw Israel under the bus by ordering Samantha Power, U.S. UN ambassador, to abstain from the recent UN vote to make Israel's settlements in East Jerusalem and Gaza illegal? You know, let's get some historical prophetic perspective on all this, shall we? As is well known to everyone in the world familiar with the history of Israel, Jerusalem has been its capital, I mean, all the way back at least 1,000 B.C., when David took that hill called Zion from the Jebusites. I mean, that's 3 millennia ago. You read about that in 2 Samuel 5. And that was back between 1018 to 1011 B.C. These squatters there now, the so-called Palestinians, have no such claim on Jerusalem. I mean, they're not the Jebusites who originally held it. The Jebusites held Jerusalem back when it was called Salem, Jeru's city, and Salem for peace, for as far back as we have history to inform us. I mean, all the way back to the days after the flood leading to Nimrod's Tower of Babel, back in Genesis 10:16, where we are told that the Jebusites were among the children of Canaan, of the family of Ham, whose favorite son is the infamous Nimrod, the original one-worlder. In Genesis 10:19, we have the earliest recorded definition of the borders of Canaan. And there it's stipulated as from Sidon in southern Lebanon, including Sidon, south, all the way down to all the way down the coast to Gaza near Egypt, and then from there eastward to the Dead Sea, and then on up back to Laish, or modern day Tel Dan, the hill of Dan, the hill of the tribe of Dan. And you'll see that in Genesis 10:19. All of this was called Canaan, and it was within the tract of land that God promised to give to Abraham and to his descendants, and you'll read about that in Genesis 15. Now, God has expressed a personal interest in the city we call Jerusalem, called Salem in Abram's day, from time immemorial. In Genesis 14, we read about a meeting between Abram and Melchizedek, and Melchizedek is identified there as king of Salem, which is Jerusalem, and a priest of the Most High God. That's interesting. The God of Abraham, you know, was the God of a king priest over Salem, who, well, probably was a Canaanite back almost 4,000 years ago. Back to 1883 B.C., and it is back in the days of this priest-king by the name of Melchizedek that God informed Abraham that Canaan land would be taken from the Canaanites and given to Abraham and his heirs. And that prophecy began its fulfillment at the time of the Exodus, about 1463 B.C., and then 40 years later when Joshua led the Israelites into the Promised Land. It's interesting, he couldn't overcome the Jebusites who held Jerusalem. Joshua 15:63. They continued to hold that city in the days of the judges. And you'll read about that in Judges 1:21, where they couldn't defeat the Jebusites holding Jerusalem. Now, all the other tribes of Canaan were dispossessed of their land and occupied by Israel, for God had given the land to Israel. He sent them in with an eviction notice from heaven. But the Jebusites, it's interesting, were able to hold Jerusalem, I mean, until, well, like 400 and more years later, until 1000 B.C., when David led his army to overcome the Jebusites and establish Jerusalem as the capital city of Israel. 2 Samuel 5 and Nehemiah 9:8. Since that time, the Israelis have occupied and held Jerusalem as their capital city. I mean, even during the diaspora in the north there, where they were scattered all out over the world, and even through the Babylonian captivity, Jerusalem was considered a city identified particularly with Judah. Jerusalem, a Jewish city, the capital of a Jewish state, all the way until AD 70, when, as Jesus prophesied, Jerusalem was destroyed, and the Jews scattered, and the days of wrath upon this people commenced and continues till this day, as we see evidence before us daily. Jesus said in Luke 21 that Jerusalem would be destroyed and the city would be trodden down by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are completed. And you read about that going on, continuing to go on in Revelation chapter 11. This did not mean Jews would not live in the land, nor did it mean, by the way, that they would have no legitimate claim on Jerusalem as their capital. What Jesus said was that Jerusalem would be trodden under the feet of Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles was fulfilled. You read about that in Luke 21:24. They shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations. And now here it is. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now that's a very important prophetic marker. God promised that in that prophetic period called the last days, Israel would once again occupy her land. In fact, more of it than she has ever occupied until now. According to Jacob's prophecy in Genesis 49, Israel is going to occupy southern Lebanon all the way up to Sidon, maybe even including Sidon, but really right at least up to that border. Genesis 49:1 tells us it's a last days prophecy. And as you read through that prophecy, you come to verse 13, where we learn that Zebulun is going to dwell at the haven of the sea, and her border will be Zidon. Now, that's scheduled for fulfillment in the future. Zebulun has never inhabited that area, a port city, at any time of its history. Furthermore, we know that in the last days, Jerusalem will be exalted among the cities, but that it will be trampled down by Gentiles. And it will be spiritually called Sodom, Revelation 11:8. It will be covered with idols, according to Isaiah 2 and Micah 4. So, you know, it seems unlikely it would continue to be controlled by Islam, but could certainly come under the influence of pagan Christianity. You know, that monstrosity that developed in Rome in the medieval period. Also, according to Isaiah 2 and Micah 4, there will be a semblance of peace prevailing throughout this area. But it's going to be one of those peace when there is no peace things, you know. What we see happening right now indicates movement, rapid movement, toward fulfillment of all these prophecies. Now, most will claim all of this began in 1948, on May 14, when the prophecy found in Ezekiel that God would initiate a gathering of his people from all over the world back to Israel had kind of built up to full steam. And it's interesting, May 14, 1948, one day before the British mandate would expire, David Ben-Gurion, you got to read his history, it's fascinating, declared the formation of the Jewish state in what was called Palestine, a geographic designation, by the way, rooted in the term Philistia and referring to that land held by the Philistines in the days of Israel's first king, Saul. Philistines as a nation do not exist today, so the term is a geographical reference now, not a reference to some nation. However, the truth is, controversy over a Jewish state began much earlier, with agitation by key Jewish leaders in Britain. Some very prestigious names that you might recognize, such as the Rothschilds. So that by and by, we come to 1917, where you have the Balfour Declaration. But we've come to the break. And so I'll need to continue our historical prophetic view of this issue when I returned. And trust me, you're going to get some in-depth understanding why liberals think a two-state solution is what is needed, why this is wrong-headed, and why, whatever solution is settled upon, Jerusalem is going to continue to be a city trodden under feet of the Gentiles until we come to the end of the world. Hold on to the break. I'll be right back.
Satan is called the dragon and prince of the power of the air. The devil beware. Pastor Scheinbach is on the air, swinging the sword of truth at the dragons of deceit, thrusting the blade of incisive insight into the belly of liberal lies, lies that blind men's mind in darkness. He wants to know if you have his back. Go to www.thebrainmassageshow.com and make your donation today, or mail it to Post Office Box 2803, Santa Maria, California, 93457. Stand by. Five, the Brain four, Massage Show three, is about to blow your mind. To say the Brain Massage Show is thought-provoking is like saying the hydrogen bomb makes a lot of noise. Both true and both way understated. Stay tuned. Your brain is about to get a massage.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Jerry Scheinbach, pastor at the Lighthouse, your brain masseur, and Paul Revere's lantern lighter, lighting the lamps in the church belfry arch, signaling the enemy is on the march. An enemy that would steal from us our liberties. Obama stabbed Israel in the back when he ordered our UN ambassador to abstain from the vote that allowed the UN to pass a resolution declaring illegal Israel's settlements in East Jerusalem and Gaza, providing a pretext for forcing Israel to remove those settlements and pressing Israel into accepting a two-state solution would involve them giving up control over Jerusalem, their historic capital, or backing out of their settlements. By the way, this will surprise you. Israel has consistently been willing to accept a two-state solution. Problem has been the terms of the arrangement and Israel's unwillingness to give up their claim on Jerusalem as their capital city. And even in that, they were willing to share the city. But more on this in a moment. Let's continue our historical prophetic view of this issue. You're going to understand why liberals support a two-state solution that involves Israel giving up Jerusalem and compromising her security, why this is wrong-headed, and why whatever solution is settled upon Jerusalem is going to continue to be a city trodden under the feet of the Gentiles until we come to the end of the world. We learned that God has had an interest in this city dating back into the beginning of recorded history when he had a priest named Melchizedek that was king of Salem, the ancient name of Jerusalem. Now, some will say this Melchizedek was Shem. Biblical evidence suggests he would have been a Jebusite or a child of Canaan. Because of the wickedness of the Canaanites, God decided to serve an eviction notice against them and give their land to Abraham's seed, the Israelites. Now, this transition began with the Exodus and continued until David finally evicted the Jebusites from Zion and made Jerusalem the capital city of Israel. And that was 1,000 years before Christ. Even through their dispersions, the infamous diaspora, Jerusalem was always recognized as a Jewish city, the capital of the Jewish people, throughout the Babylonian captivity. And afterward, when rebuilt by Ezra and Nehemiah, everybody around the entire area recognized Jerusalem belonged to the Jews. Throughout the Persian and the Grecian empires, all the way up to the time of the Roman Empire, the birth of Christ, Jerusalem has been the capital city of Israel. Jesus prophesied that the Jews would reject their king, Jesus Christ, the promised Messiah, whose birth we recently celebrated, and that their city would afterwards be destroyed, and it wouldn't have been if they had received Christ, and they would enter into a time of wrath upon this people, and that during this time, Jerusalem would be trampled under the feet of Gentiles, and that this would continue until the times of the Gentiles were fulfilled. And all that began in AD 70. It continues today. Ezekiel, however, prophesied a regathering of the Jews to Israel, not for their sake, but for his name's sake. In other words, we know there's going to be, finally, a time when Israel will repent. They'll see Christ, whom they wounded, and be birthed as a nation in a day, and all that's going to happen. But there's another prophecy that tells us that before that happens, there will be a time when Israel will be regathered from all over the world, and that they would reoccupy their land, rebuild Jerusalem, finally expand their borders beyond what they were in David's day, and at least with regard to the northernmost borders of Israel. They will be at peace with their neighbors. The city of Jerusalem will be exalted among the nations, and yet it will be overrun with idols, and the city will have the character of Sodom. It will be spiritually called Sodom. Now, what we're looking at right now is the history of the fulfillment of these prophecies. For many centuries now, Jerusalem has been tossed back and forth between this army, that army. The Mohammedans take it, the Christians take it, the British take it, the French take it, the British take it back and on and on and on. And finally, in the early part of the 20th century, things began to shape up to begin the fulfillment of the regathering of the Jews to their promised land, Israel. Now, as a side note, it's important to understand, Jews have always had an interest and, by the way, a presence in Jerusalem. Scattered, and pretty much without power, and not politically identifiable, oppressed, trampled upon, but present. So, here's how it came to pass that Israel was reestablished in her land as a nation. First, given the history of the Jews, no one with any understanding of human nature would deny that an undercurrent of interest in returning to Israel ran deep in the souls of Jews in many parts of the world. Throughout that culture, desires percolated to the surface, really as early as 1697, when a rabbi led 1,500 pilgrim Jews to return to Israel and settle there. 1,000 made it, and they arrived October 14, 1700. That began a growing tide of immigration of Jews back to their homeland. Well, commensurate with that, tensions began to develop between them and their Muslim neighbors as they began organizing their communities and establishing a kind of politically viable presence in the land. The Zionist movement is said by most to have officially begun in 1839 with a wealthy Orthodox British Jew traveling to Palestine and encouraging immigration, promoting a plan to establish Jewish colonies all over Palestine. And again, many followed his lead, and as these colonies prospered and occupied the land that was left waste by Muslims till then, basically, jealousies were provoked. And when efforts to Islam them to the oppressive control of their Arab neighbors were met with resistance on the part of the Jews there, well, tensions continued to build. They were increasingly perceived as a threat to Arab control in the region, or Muslim control in the region. By 1895, the reputed founder of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, began attempting to recruit the Rothschilds into the effort to colonize Palestine. Herzl published a pamphlet titled The Jewish State. That was in 1896, and this presented the first official public call for the organization of a Jewish state. Now, that stirred up many Jewish people, and it was it developed into the first outbreak of public Zionism. Meanwhile, immigration of Jews to Israel continued to increase, and resistance and tensions increased right along with that increase in immigration between the Muslim Arabs and the Jews. The efforts to promote a Jewish state began to gather more interest, and right along with that, resistance to Jews having a place within their ancient homeland also increased, and so the debate began to form, and even broke out into some violence from time to time. Anyway, Arthur Balfour, Britain's Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs in 1917, wrote to Lord Rothschild, a Jewish Brit, then a prominent leader of the Jewish people, who was sympathetic, by the way, to the Zionist movement. He wrote the following to him: "I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country," end quote. So what's important here is you can see that right from the beginning, there was a kind of two-state solution ideology here. And this became known as the Balfour Declaration. Some think this was done to solicit Jewish support, particularly the Rothschild support during the Great War, World War I. Now, others think it was a natural development in Britain that was home to many Jewish people and where the Zionist movement had a kind of headquarters and had grown quite strong. This movement became attached to resistance against German aggression. The involvement of Zionists in the effort to defeat Germany in World War I, and particularly the involvement and the activity of Rothschilds, or the alleged activity of Rothschilds, led to a lot of the issues Hitler pointed to later on to justify murdering the Jews. It was about this time some guy named Hussein of Mecca declared himself king of the Arab peoples and assumed rule over all of Palestine. Not everyone agreed with his presumptuous claim, and that includes many who lived in Palestine, and not only the Jews, but also some Arabs. After World War I, the Western powers carved up Palestine, and British mandate was established, providing a sort of imposed order over the area, policing the dispute between Arabs and Jews' claims for rights to the land. This mandate recognized Israel as having a right to live in their colonized Jewish homeland, albeit not as a state, and to live alongside their Arab neighbors, who would also have equal rights to their land and so on. This had in it the hints at a two-state solution, as I pointed out, although at this time, there was no formal state to divide between them. After the war with Hitler's Germany ended, there was a wave of pro-Israeli sentiment and a general feeling that Israel needed to be restored to their land. As this began to develop, the Arabs in the area began to feel threatened, even more so, and began to react very negatively. And of course, the biases of the Muslim people against the Jews have roots that go back into what the Bible calls the old hatred. I mean, aside from the political concerns, there's this cultural issue. Ezekiel 25:15 tells us, "Thus saith the Lord God, because the Philistines have dealt by revenge and have taken vengeance with a despiteful heart to destroy it, for the old hatred," end quote. So you see, this has been going on for a very long time. Now, this old hatred refers to a combination of things. First, the fact that God sent Israel into Canaan with an eviction notice against Canaan, Palestine, the Philistines, and so on. And then you add to this the fact that Ishmael, son of Abraham by the Egyptian Hagar, so he's half Canaanite, prophesied to be the progenitor of a people noteworthy for their rage and anger. And then these mingled with Esau's seed, who was the brother of Jacob, and the family that became the nemesis of Jacob's seed, the father of Israel. So, you know, my point is you've got a very rotten, corrosive bitterness at the very heart of the relationships here that run way deep into history, and speaking culturally now. Now, so you add to that the political concerns and the resistance for either side to be governed by the other, and you begin to get the picture. This old hatred is really the taproot of the cultural divide between Arab peoples and Jews. Now, let's look at the two-state solution. Now, first, this has been attempted 7 times, and in virtually every case, the Muslims have been the ones who sabotaged the effort. In every case, it's come down to that little city of Jerusalem, by the way, at the end of the day. Many other things can be agreed to, but when you get to that city, they just can't do it. The Bible calls Jerusalem the burdensome stone. In Zechariah 12:3, and in that day I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. End quote. Now here are the 7 times that Israel agreed to a two-state solution, and the so-called Palestinians rejected it. My point here is that Israel is not opposed to a two-state solution. In 1937, the British Peel Commission recommended a two-state solution. Israel said yes, the Arab states said no. 1947, the UN resolution creating two states was rejected by the Arabs but accepted by Israel. And throughout the period from 1949 through 1967, Egypt and Jordan could, because they had borders there, could easily have established a Palestinian state on the West Bank. No one would have objected. Not the Jews, not the international community, nobody. And Gaza. And by the way, even in East Jerusalem, it wouldn't have been a problem back then. But they chose not to do it. And that's because it would have involved tacit recognition of Israel as a state. And that's coming out of that old hatred. See, 1967, Israel agreed to give back the captured territories immediately after the Six-Day War in exchange for a real peace with her Arab neighbors. The Arabs refused. Why? Because it would involve recognition of Israel as a legitimate state. And the old hatred wouldn't let them go. In 2000, at Camp David, U.S. proposed a two-state solution. It involved Israel making virtually all the concessions, but Yasser Arafat said no, refusing to acknowledge Israel. This he did for political reasons. The people that supported him had that old hatred. 2001, the Taba proposal, or the Taba proposal. As to who is responsible for the failure to achieve an agreement in Taba, there are arguments supporting both sides. The most careful and, I think, objective analysis of that whole summit is in my research file for this show and available to you. I agree that disagreement over Jerusalem, and particularly over the holy sites, was actually what was going to derail the whole thing anyway. The facts are that a terrorist attack provoked Israel to back off, but then the Palestinian side expressed a genuine desire to continue and felt they were getting close to an agreement. And so further negotiations continued, but in sort of an unofficial capacity. Anyway, political concerns on Israel's side is said by some to be what killed the Taba summit. But then Israel says that they sent word to Arafat and they got word back that he did not want to make a deal. And so, according to them, that's what killed it. So it's time to conclude the show. I hope the background, both historical and prophetic, has been helpful. Let's sum it up. You see, prophecy tells us that we can expect the following. Israel will occupy much more of her original homeland than she now enjoys, all the way up to Sidon in Lebanon. Israel will have her temple rebuilt, and Jerusalem will be exalted among the nations during a time of relative peace with her neighbors. And all of this will certainly happen before the Antichrist shows up to do his deal with Israel. But we'll get into that another time. Because Jerusalem will be overrun with idols, according to the prophets Isaiah and Micah, and because freedom of religion will prevail throughout, same prophets, same chapters, it seems either that Islam will lose its influence in the region or will undergo a very thorough transformation from what we see now. And by the way, all of this will happen during the period leading up to the end, during what the Bible calls the last days, a prophetic period that began at Pentecost and continues today. When we look at the history from this prophetic perspective, well, it's easy to see that current events are moving us toward the fulfillment of these prophecies. As for whether the Jews have a right to a state in their ancient homeland, well, of course they do. I mean, humanly speaking, of course they do. And then biblically, God has promised the land to Israel. Although Jesus did say they would be under a judgment for many years and that Jerusalem would be a burdensome stone for all the nations of the world, and we can understand that as we approach any agreement between the two sides, you can expect it to come down to what will be done with Jerusalem. Whatever is agreed to, Jerusalem is going to be at the center of it and will be trodden down under the feet of Gentiles, whatever the decision is. So the best that can be hoped for would be an agreement that recognizes Jerusalem as a divided city, perhaps, or perhaps as a universal or an international city. the Jews are more likely to accept that kind of an idea than the Arabs would be. But we'll see. It looks to me like Islam is going to be broken in the region, and that means we can expect some kind of serious war to break out that's going to end with Israel expanding her borders yet more, and Jerusalem becoming something like an international city, perhaps a center of a world court, or perhaps a religious center where all religions converge and have a representation and so on. Perhaps Israel will have it all as their capital, but it'll be an open international city. As for me, I certainly support Israel's right to the land and believe she would be much more willing to share Jerusalem than the Muslims ever would be. And what I'm praying for is that the barriers to the gospel will be removed throughout that region, and so Christ's offer of peace on earth can be generally preached throughout the Jewish and Islamic worlds. I have lit the lamps in the church belfry arch. Now you call and let me know, see if they are on. And I do appreciate those of you who take the time to give me a call, especially in this busy holiday season. Call 1-888-770-8000. Again, that's 1-888-770-8000. Or go to our website, thebrainmassageshow.com. That's thebrainmassageshow.com. You'll see there a place to make a donation to radio broadcast costs, and we would really appreciate your help, and it's very much needed right now. You'll also see there a place where you can write to me an email. And I'll be presenting an Issachar report on this issue of a divided Jerusalem in my Sunday night message, Sunday night, 6 p.m. at the Lighthouse. God bless you. God save America. And I'll see you in church.
For a complete brain massage experience, tune in Saturday at 12 noon